Farewell Cassini, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's the end of the line for NASA's Cassini space probe. It was one heck of a ride, gathering insights into Saturn and its largest moon, Titan.
On Earth, mountains are made out of rock. On Titan, the mountains are made out of water. And when we have volcanoes on Titan, molten water, liquid water, oozes out onto the surface.
Plus, North Korea tests another missile, but weapons aren't the only obstacle to peace with the North. There's also a group of singing waitresses.
They swirl around the restaurant and sort of exalt the regime in a very fun and kitschy way. They wear spangly gowns, they play the accordion, the guitar, the drums, they waltz with customers, and they play standards like Country Roads.
The music, the intrigue, and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you along with us today. A lot has happened in the past 24 hours, judging from the steady flow of news alerts on my phone. Just two examples: North Korea's latest missile launch, which plunged into the sea, and NASA's Cassini space probe, which was sent plunging to its demise in Saturn's atmosphere. We'll get to North Korea, Cassini, and more this hour, but we begin with the latest on that blast inside a London Underground train this morning. British police said right away they were investigating the explosion as an act of terror, and since then ISIS has claimed responsibility. It is not unusual for the group to claim such attacks hours after the fact. And then Prime Minister Theresa May announced that Britain's national threat level has been raised to critical. That is the maximum level, meaning that British authorities consider another attack to be imminent. The World's Leo Hornack is with us from London. Leo, what can you tell us about what happened?
Well, what we know at the moment, Marco, is that at 8:20 a.m. this morning, which is obviously the height of the rush hour, a device on a very crowded commuter tube train began to burn. It's described as a wall of flame at a place called Parsons Green, which is a kind of suburban train station in the west of London. No one was killed, but the hospitals have said they've now treated 29 people for injuries. And the crush to try and escape the train was pretty horrendous. Here's what one eyewitness said she saw as it happened.
We just heard the loudest, scariest screams coming from what sounded like the carriage right next to us, and loud men shouting, "Run." So when people shout, "Run," you run. And we just all ran for our lives. And we got to the steps and it was just the worst. It was like a proper human crush. And there was women underneath me. There's a lady saying, "I'm pregnant." There's a little boy. His face had got smacked into the step. It was just like there was just layers and layers of people screaming.
Pandemonium.
And the other thing that is particularly worrying about this is that this device was detonated on a timer. There was no suicide attack in this case, we're pretty sure. Mm. The person who did this is still on the loose. And that raises the question, did they just prepare one device or more?
Yeah, some of the reports I've been seeing, speaking of that device, this device was somewhat unusual and didn't work as planned.
Right, and that's almost certainly what saved lives today. It's described as an improvised explosive device, an IED, and when you do something in an improvised way, things can go wrong from the point of view of the terrorist. And that's what the police think happened here, that it failed to detonate properly. There was no blast wave, as almost certainly was intended, which meant that although people were injured, there wasn't the kind of carnage that you've seen on other attacks in a crowded train.
This obviously is not the first terror attack in Britain this year. There was the Ariana Grande concert attack, the attack on Parliament as well. Mm-hmm. How would you say Britain's attitude to terrorism is changing?
Well, it's the fifth attack this year, if you add them all up. And I mean, it's strange, Mark. It feels like on a pretty regular basis, I'm talking to you to describe some horrific event happening in Britain. And I wish I could say that I thought this would be the last time, but I don't think anyone thinks that right now. It's almost become part of the expected events of a year in Britain at the moment. But it sort of sticks in my throat a little bit to start accepting that as a new normal.
The World's Leo Hornack in London. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Marco.
North and South Korea could really use some peace talks. There are many barriers to this happening, of course. One is North Korea's provocative drive to test and develop nuclear weapons. See its latest launch of a long-range missile right over Japan. Another obstacle? A dozen singing waitresses. And here to explain what that means is the world's Patrick Nguyen. What are we talking about here, Patrick?
Okay, so the first thing to understand is that the North Korean regime operates about 100 restaurants throughout the world. Most of them are in Asia. The star attraction at these restaurants is not the food, which is usually not that great. It's the singing, dancing waitresses. And they swirl around the restaurant and sort of exalt the regime in a very fun and kitschy way. They wear spangly gowns, they play the accordion, the guitar, the drums, they waltz with customers, and they play standards like Country Roads.
This is surreal, Patrick.
Yeah, you know, these women are very, very well trained. Back home, they belong to a very strict arts and performance regimen, and they're usually picked from a very young age to become artists, as young as 9 or 10.
And, like, they've gone to music schools for professional training kind of thing?
Yeah, someone with the government will go around to the primary schools and look for little girls with very big eyes and long legs if they're going to be dancers, or maybe long fingers if they want them to play the piano, and they will be trained to perform for elites in Pyongyang. They're not telling them, hey, little girl, you're going to be a waitress overseas one day. But these women that might end up in the orchestra or they might end up in the national band, if they're maybe not so talented, then they shunt them over to work in these restaurants.
Okay, Patrick, how did these singing waitresses become embroiled in the conflict on the Korean Peninsula?
Great question. Yeah, so last April, at one of these North Korean regime-run restaurants in China, the minders who conduct surveillance on this restaurant from the North Korean government showed up, and 12 of the waitresses had just vanished. They resurfaced in South Korea, and this was totally unprecedented. It looked like one of the biggest mass defections ever.
A political tug of war is playing out in a South Korean court over 12 detained North Korean waitresses who reportedly fled from China. While Pyongyang.
And all of these women are children of elite families. So it looked like a really, really big coup for South Korea. In fact, the government was saying, oh, they planned it themselves. And they did so after watching South Korean soap operas, which just caused their ideology to collapse, and they came running to South Korea. Now, as you might imagine, North Korea had a totally different take. They said they were abducted and swept to South Korea by secret agents. You know, I hate to be the person to say this, but it's plausible that that is true. We shouldn't dismiss that claim totally out of hand because the circumstances are very fishy. But regardless, North Korea has filled its airwaves with the sound of families of these waitresses crying and wailing and begging for South Korea to return their children or else. So the bottom line is North Korea says it's not going to negotiate peace with South Korea until these women are returned back home.
I'm still baffled, Patrick, why these waitresses are so important to North Korea. Like Pyongyang would blow a peace deal over waitresses?
Yes, and that should actually be taken very seriously. These women have become sort of geopolitical chess pieces. I think the first thing to understand is that obviously right now peace talks are on pause. You know, North Korea is firing missiles over Japan. It's not going to happen until that calms down. But the South Korean president, he has staked much of his reputation on leading Kim Jong-un towards peace talks away from war. So he's come up with these series of steps that can get the ball rolling. Step one, he's like, let's have family reunions. We can cooperate on that. People who are separated between the two nations, let's reunite them. And North Korea says, well, no, you've just kidnapped 12 of our women. You're causing more family rifts. So that's going to have to be settled before the peace talks can even begin. North Korea has really planted its flag on this issue. It said, you know, if you want us to trust you, this is where it starts. You have to give us our waitresses back. It's your move, South Korea.
Country Roads, take me home. The world's Patrick Nguyen. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
West Jamaica, North Korea. Those singing waitresses aren't the only obstacles to a potential peace deal between North and South Korea. As I said earlier, there are North Korea's provocative missile launches and Pyongyang's efforts to expand its nuclear stockpile. More quietly, the North has been doing something else, trying to steal Bitcoin and other virtual currencies by hacking into South Korean cryptocurrency exchanges.
These are essentially places where people can buy or sell different cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ethereum. It's similar to how you might trade on the stock market, but specifically for cryptocurrencies.
That's Luke McNamara. He's with the security firm FireEye, and he published a report this week looking at North Korea's attempts to steal these digital currencies.
I think to first put this activity into context, we have to go back to 2016, and that's where we first witnessed this group, a group that we call Temp Hermit, begin to target global banks and a payment processor to steal money. Initially marks the first time we've seen a nation state use its offensive cyber capability for direct financial gain. So flash forward now in 2017, and what this report is really about is we've observed these same actors target cryptocurrency exchanges in South Korea.
And have you been able to link these hacking attempts to the regime of Kim Jong-un?
Because this is based out of North Korea, and a lot of the other targeting that we've seen them conduct has been of strategic interest to the North Korean regime, targets that they would specifically be interested in, we assess with a high likelihood that this group is working in concert with the North Korean intelligence entities.
Right. So it's got those hallmarks of Pyongyang. Are you able to track how much money North Korea has managed to steal through these hacks?
Yeah, we haven't seen the specific numbers of how much they've been able to successfully exfiltrate from some of the digital wallets on these exchanges. We know at least one of these breaches was successful. And I think if you also look at the amount of daily trading volume in South Korea, it's pretty significant and makes up a big portion of the global trading in cryptocurrencies. So these are pretty big targets that they're going after. And then I think you have the other fact is that Bitcoin and Ethereum and a lot of other cryptocurrencies have appreciated pretty significantly in value this year. And it makes logical sense that if you're interested in stealing Bitcoin, these exchanges are a big centralized target to focus on.
So if, in fact, this is North Korea doing this, for months now, there have been talks of sanctions against North Korea. And on Monday, the UN did approve some. Do you think North Korea has been stashing Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to soften the impact of sanctions?
Yeah, I think you can't ignore the fact that sanctions play a huge role in this. Cryptocurrencies definitely allow them one way to evade sanctions. It enables them to get hard cash because what they're able to do if they successfully compromise a digital wallet that's storing Bitcoin, they could transfer that out. They could send that to a different exchange and cash it out for a hard fiat currency. So if you look at some of the other illicit financial activity they're rumored to be involved in, things like counterfeiting and money laundering, they definitely see bringing in currency as a significant way to bolster the regime and fund their various government programs.
We've been reporting on the world about Bitcoin for a couple of years. And my sense, even though you said Bitcoin has kind of gone up in value recently, is that it's not the most stable currency. Do you think this could come back to bite North Korea economically?
There is a lot of volatility at present within the cryptocurrency market, as this is kind of an emerging asset class. But I think the advantages of it being something that is essentially a stateless currency probably outweighs some of that volatility, given that they're able to get around some of the anti-money laundering controls in traditional markets.
Luke McNamara, a senior analyst with the security firm FireEye, thanks for telling us about this.
My pleasure.
Harvard disinvites Chelsea Manning as a visiting fellow. That story's up next here on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Earlier this week, Chelsea Manning was invited to be a visiting fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Big honor for the 29-year-old former military whistleblower. That did not sit well, though, with many military and intelligence veterans, nor with the current head of the CIA. So early this morning, the K School backed down. The World's Chris Wolf has been following events.
Chelsea Manning is one of the biggest leakers of secrets in U.S. history. As a young soldier in Baghdad, Manning was appalled by what she saw happening in Iraq, like this video of a U.S. helicopter firing on a TV crew.
Light them all up. traffic 260.
Come on, fire.
Hey, Roger.
Keep shoot.
Keep shooting. In this instance, the helicopter crew believed the TV camera was a shoulder-launched weapon, but to Manning, it appeared like cold-blooded murder. So she arranged to give files, documents, videos like this to WikiLeaks, which promptly published them. Manning was eventually caught, brought to trial, and convicted of 17 charges, including 5 counts of espionage. She received a 30-year sentence, which was later commuted by President Obama. She was freed in May after serving 7 years. To many in the military and intelligence community, Manning is simply a traitor who put them and their comrades in danger.
What Chelsea did to release this information and expose these people to greater peril, I mean, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, what an extraordinary betrayal.
Kevin Kit Parker is a former Army paratrooper who served multiple tours in Afghanistan. But Parker is also a professor of bioengineering and applied physics at Harvard. He had a pretty strong reaction to the decision by Harvard's Kennedy School to name Manning a visiting fellow.
Many people in Harvard's veterans community, we've got about 200-something veterans on the campus, feel as if they've been betrayed by Harvard.
Parker sent a letter of resignation to the Kennedy School, where he'd been teaching a joint program on innovation. He says he will, however, remain at the engineering school. Other protests came thick and fast. CIA Director Mike Pompeo cancelled a speech planned for last night, while Michael Morell, former acting director of the CIA, resigned as a senior fellow. So early this morning, the Kennedy School reversed course. Manning can still come speak, but will not be called a visiting fellow. In a statement, Dean Douglas Elmendorf said the invitation was never an endorsement of Manning's conduct. He said he didn't realize people saw the title of visiting fellow as a particular honor. But now he sees that was a mistake.
It seems that Harvard knew exactly what it was doing when it invited her to be a visiting fellow and decided that it wouldn't stand by its own decision, and that's unfair to Chelsea Manning.
That's Spencer Ackerman, national security reporter for the Daily Beast. Ackerman takes particular issue with the idea that Manning's leaks caused harm to anyone.
We get typically the most lurid descriptions of what the impacts of these leaks are. They turn out not to manifest, and then there's not really a lot of push for a disclosure, a taxonomy, and accounting of what the actual harm was.
Other security specialists disagree, but Ackerman says there's a still wider issue to consider here.
We all, just as a society, ought to take a deep breath and consider if we want to continually punish people who've done their time, particularly when the actual impact of their crimes is a fact, not an evidence.
Chelsea Manning herself tweeted today that she was, quote, honored to be the first disinvited trans woman visiting fellow, and added, they chill marginalized voices under CIA pressure. For The World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
In Russia this month, a court ruling against the national airline Aeroflot got a lot of attention. The court ordered Aeroflot to compensate 2 female flight attendants for lost wages, wages the women said they were denied because of their body size. My BBC colleague Sarah Rainsford has more from Moscow.
From the adverts for Aeroflot, it's clear that slim is in. The flight attendants on screen are tall and slender, gliding through an airport in red stiletto heels. But when Aeroflot tried to achieve that look in real life by linking its crew's pay to their dress size, it came unstuck.
So this is where you have your uniform.
Yevgenia Magorina has a wardrobe full of Aeroflot's distinctive red uniform. But last year, she says the airline stopped handing out the larger size she needs.
So you had to add this bit.
It's my little secret.
This is to make it big enough.
Then she realised it wasn't just her dress that had shrunk, it was her salary too.
I was in shock at first. It made no sense. How could they cut your pay because of your dress size? But an Aeroflot document said the success of a stewardess depended on her size. Of course, that really offended me.
Aeroflot strenuously denies discrimination. But Yevgenia's shown me a letter telling her she's over the required, pretty average dress size. She's also been removed from more lucrative long-haul flights. Yevgenia says hundreds of other stewardesses have been affected. They dubbed themselves STS, That's the Russian initials for old, fat, and ugly. The airline made appearance their priority, Yevgenia told me. But flight attendants are rescuers above all, she says. So it's absurd. It's also surprising, perhaps, for Russia, 100 years after a revolution which prided itself on promoting equality. Russia is, after all, the country that put the first ever woman in space. But decades after Valentina Tereshkova's record-breaking flight, I met a Russian woman who's fighting for the right to captain a boat. We head out onto the Volga River, and Svetlana Medvedeva tells me how she was denied a job because of a law here that bans women from more than 450 professions. The list includes driving trucks and trains and even carpentry. It is supposedly to protect women's reproductive health, but as Svetlana points out, it's a blanket ban.
A woman should be able to decide for herself who she wants to be and whether she has children. It's her right, and women are not always pregnant.
So Svetlana is on a one-woman mission against the list. She spent the last 5 years fighting a discrimination case in court.
I don't think there is equality in Russia. It's a very patriarchal country. I think the only movement here is backwards. Maybe they give women some positions in government, but this list of banned professions speaks for itself.
Back in Moscow, Yevgenia Magorina has already had her day in court. There, amongst other things, the Aeroflot lawyer tried to defend cutting her pay by arguing that every extra kilo of weight cost the airline more in fuel. But the judge ruled against him, leaving Yevgenia hugging her friends and lawyers in tears of disbelief. I hope this means women will be braver now in fighting for their rights, she told me, as the flight attendant notched up one victory in what is clearly a much bigger battle here.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford there in Moscow.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. A 13-deck cruise ship just sailed through northern waters that used to be solid ice. Which means for some Inuit people, their Arctic village is now a port of call.
Sometimes the elders say, why are these big, big cruise ships coming through our path?
Good question. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This week in Boston, a cruise ship pulled into port. Nothing unusual there, except where this ship had been. It's called the Crystal Serenity, and it's on the tail end of a 32-day journey through the Northwest Passage in the Canadian Arctic. It's a big boat with a capacity of 1,700 guests and crew. It's the biggest passenger ship yet to travel the route from Alaska to Greenland. And it's only able to do that because the sea ice up there is melting. That means a lot more people can get there than ever before.
I'm John Harris, and I'm from Houston, Texas.
I met John Harris and some other passengers in the shadow of the 13-deck ship, and I asked them about their favorite moments on the trip.
Gosh, there are really so many, but I think the sighting of the first polar bear, to see him lumbering along, at one point he dived into the open sea, came back out, and it was just fabulous.
And my name is Estelle Seitman. From St. Louis, Missouri.
Estelle?
Yes.
Estelle, if there's one image from this cruise that you'll kind of reflect on, what's that image?
I think it's the ice. Icebergs, sea ice, like sculptures in all different hues. You know, I don't ever think I want to go to the Caribbean again. I'm in love with the ice.
There was a steep price tag on indulging that love, though. The cruise ticket price starts at $1,000 a day.
Hello, sir. How are you? Excuse us.
Crystal Cruises Vice President John Stoll walked me up the gangplank of the ship and pointed out some of its amenities. Fine dining options, even a sushi bar, and an open-air atrium with a heated pool.
While we were in the Northwest Passage, the pool was heated at 84 degrees. Wow. So we actually have an aerial with a helicopter with people in the pool.
Stoll took me to the observation deck where not long ago passengers had marveled at a polar bear on an iceberg just 100 feet off the stern. It was just one of the many ironies of this kind of voyage.
So, John, down on the dock earlier, it occurred to me that no matter how careful cruise companies are, the ships still have this massive environmental footprint. There's wastewater release, there's carbon emissions from fuel. How do you try to find this balance between letting people on the ship see these amazing areas, this incredible wildlife, and not making bigger problems for the Arctic than already exists?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was a big concern of ours when we first got into this venture. We developed a system where we didn't have to offload garbage the entire time we were in the Northwest Passage. Emissions-wise, we burned high-grade fuel, which burns cleaner. Hopefully, we set the bar, and we set it high.
Cruise experts do give Crystal high marks for its environmental practices on this cruise, but many Arctic experts say it's not just about one ship. They're seeing the beginning of a new era of mass tourism in the far north, and that could take a real toll. Cleanups from any accidents would be hard to stage in a region that's already under enormous stress from climate change.
The ability to go through the Northwest Passage now is because of melting ice, and the ice is melting because of climate change. So in a way, you're benefiting from climate change. Does that feel awkward?
You know, I don't know. I've never really thought of it in that terms. We were lucky with the ice. I think you're right. 10 years, 15 years ago, we never would have been able to make the journey. But I think, again, exposure to the region gives us a better sense of what's happening.
Passenger Estelle Seitman says she does feel like she got a close-up view of climate change.
You know, you see how many of the glaciers are retreating. I've seen it for myself with my own eyes. It worries me.
How do you feel about kind of almost piggybacking on the impact of climate change to see this beauty?
I feel incredibly lucky that I have seen this in my life. And I want other folks to be able to see this. And I worry that it won't be a possibility.
Cruise passengers like Seitman are passing witnesses to what's happening in the Arctic. But for the indigenous peoples who live along the Northwest Passage, this part of the world is also home. And that home is changing fast, and we also wanted to hear from them. So my colleague Carolyn Beeler called up two residents of the village of Cambridge Bay in Nunavut, where the Crystal Serenity dropped anchor.
Cambridge Bay is a small Inuit community on Canada's Victoria Island, almost 2,000 miles north of Toronto. And when the Crystal Serenity anchored there for the first time last summer, it was 10 times bigger than any cruise ship to stop there before.
It wasn't in the bay because it's too big and it couldn't fit in there.
This is Mia Otakayak, who drove out of town with her family to see the ship.
It was just like jaw-dropping to think that the same amount of people that are in Cambridge Bay could fit onto that ship.
That's about 1,800 people. Otakayak's grandmother, Eva Kakulak, watched from out on the tundra this year as passengers from the Crystal Serenity were picked up from the beach and driven into town.
Those trucks and four-wheelers were racing back and forth to the ship and back to the town.
Cambridge Bay is not used to this influx of visitors. Most of its gravel roads dead-end at the edge of town, and beyond that, there's nothing but flat brown earth. Otakayak is an outgoing 21-year-old, so I asked her what she does for fun there.
Well, because I've lived here my entire life, I've found that there's not much to do anymore. I do love to go out on the land.
She likes to hunt and fish and camp, visit her grandmother's cabin.
And it's very peaceful for a lot of us to go out where our ancestors were.
But that peace is being interrupted by the changing climate in the Arctic. Melting sea ice means cruise ships going through the Northwest Passage stop in Cambridge Bay several times a year now.
When I first heard that the Crystal Serenity was coming here, I have mixed feelings. My biggest negative is always just how much traffic that's bringing in into our ocean that we use.
The elders always say, why are these big cruise ships coming through our path? And the owls were about the water because we get food from the water. Seals, fish, white fish, walrus, but seals are the main thing that Inuit eat a lot.
Unlike many of the Serenity's passengers, Otakayak and Kakalak see a direct link between the cruise and climate change. But disappearing ice isn't the only evidence they see around them.
I have not seen muskox in almost 2 years. So that's really strange.
And it's getting so much harder to travel out on the land because the permafrost is melting and causing huge cracks in the earth. There's some cracks that are probably like 6 feet. And if you fell in there with a quad, your quad would be totaled.
Quads are four-wheelers or ATVs, what a lot of people use to get around the tundra. This ecosystem is changing fast. And there's a lot of worry about what an influx of tourists in the Canadian North might mean for the delicate region. But that is not the whole picture.
There's always the flip side of that.
Otakayak says the ships also bring in money. Last year, Cambridge Bay hosted an art fair for visitors, and she helped two of her uncles sell their carvings and paintings.
Both of them had families that they had to feed. Both of them didn't have jobs. So it was really, really nice to see that because of the Crystal Serenity, they got to make a lot of money for their families.
Both Mia Otakayak and her grandmother, Eva Kakalak, worry about the future here in a community on the front lines of climate change. But they remain cautiously optimistic.
I have a lot of worries for my future grandchildren. So I am hoping that the community will put their heads together and teach more about this to the young generation.
They're hoping that their family and the town of Cambridge Bay can adapt to the changes as they come, from melting ice and permafrost to the new waves of tourists who come as that ice disappears. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
On to a story now about a very different kind of ship.
The signal from the spacecraft is gone, and within the next 45 seconds, so will be the spacecraft.
From NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, that's the voice there of a mission controller of the Cassini spacecraft announcing the end of its 20-year mission to Saturn as the ship dove into the clouds this morning of Saturn and burned up.
I'm going to call this the end of mission. Project manager, off the net.
Ari Daniel from NOVA is with us. There's been a lot of love for this mission over the last 20 years, Ari. We heard some applause there at the moment the Cassini went dark and started to disintegrate. But I'm imagining a lot of sadness, too. What was the mood among mission scientists there this morning?
You know, it was a real mix. Certainly, there was a lot of triumph. The fact that Cassini has been successfully piloted for the last 13 years in orbit throughout the Saturn system. And there was also certainly some sadness. This is Jonathan Lunin, who's the director of the Cornell Center for Astrophysics and Planetary Science, who's been with the mission from the beginning.
It's hard to see the end of Cassini. We always knew it would have to end sometime, but that's such a difficult thing to do with a spacecraft that's done so much as Cassini has done.
Yeah, so Ari Daniel, remind us what Cassini has done all these years.
It's taught us an incredible amount, Marco. It's taught us about Saturn's rings, letting us know that they are an incredibly dynamic place and probably made out of water ice. It's also told us about the kind of storm systems that move around Saturn. It's given us remarkable photographs of Saturn and its moons. And it's also keyed us into two very special moons of Saturn, Enceladus and Titan, two moons that have conditions that could potentially harbor life. Here is Trina Ray, who's been with the mission for 21 years and is an astronomer with the Cassini Project, talking about Titan.
I would say it's the most Earth-like body in the solar system. It has a thick atmosphere. That atmosphere interacts with the surface. There is a cycle. On the Earth, it's a hydrological cycle with water. We have water rain. We have water rivers and then water lakes and seas. On Titan, we have methane and ethane rain and methane and ethane lakes and seas. But the water is frozen solid. The mountains on Titan are made out of frozen water. And when we have volcanoes on Titan, molten water, liquid water, oozes out onto the surface. And there's dunes, wind-blown dunes. But remember, the little particles of the dunes on Titan are little ice chips.
Wow, that is mind-blowing. So why this abrupt end, Ari? Why not just let Cassini keep going and going, like, you know, the New Horizons probe, which sent us those incredible images from Pluto a couple of years ago? It just continued out of the solar system.
Cassini was basically out of fuel, Marco, and there was a concern that it could crash onto either Titan or Enceladus, the two moons that I mentioned may have the conditions for harboring life. And it's possible that Earth microbes could have survived the 20-year mission and contaminate those distant moons of the Saturn system. So they wanted to make absolutely sure that there was no chance of that happening, and so that's why they sent it into Saturn's atmosphere to burn it up.
So, Ari, I got to ask, how can the researchers be so sure that there's no life to interfere with on Saturn itself?
It's a great question, Marco. I actually posed it to Trina Ray. Here she is.
As it goes into Saturn, within just a minute, it burns up. So we don't have to worry about any microbes because they would not survive. We're going in at, 60, 70, 80,000 miles an hour, something. I forgot the actual number. It's going to melt titanium in a minute. So, yeah, just don't worry about it.
Okay, I'm convinced. Ari, now Cassini is history, but Saturn and its moons are still fascinating, and I'm guessing we still have a lot to learn from them. Are we going to go back to Saturn?
Well, right now there are no missions planned, Marco. All they've got planned is a mission to Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, where there is an ocean of liquid water beneath an icy crust, in the hopes of discovering some alien life in the Jupiter system. But right now, there are no more missions planned for Saturn. However, scientists will be submitting proposals to go back to the system to continue to learn about the things that Cassini has taught us in terms of the planet and the moons of Saturn.
Ari Daniel with our partner program NOVA here at WGBH. He's in Pasadena, California today for the last moments of the Cassini-Saturn probe. Ari, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
You can catch NOVA's Death Dive to Saturn, including coverage of Cassini's last moments, at pbs.org/NOVA. They've also produced a short video highlighting six key discoveries from Cassini's 20-year mission to Saturn. You can watch that over on our Facebook page. Just search for The World. A quick look now at a story we're working on for Monday's program. It's about how some Americans are showing support for immigrant neighbors who might be targeted for deportation. They're forming what they call rapid response teams. Here's how they work. If an ICE agent approaches an immigrant's home, volunteers hear about it right away.
The dispatcher is sending out a text, okay, saying, can you respond? You text back, OTW, on the way.
Monday on The World, we go to a training session where volunteers learn how to be observers.
When you get out of the car, have your phone out already and have your pencil or notepad out already. The last thing you want to do is be approaching ICE and reaching in the back pocket for your phone.
Witnessing ICE raids, coming up on the show on Monday. We have an update now on an unlikely hero. Remember Benjamin Ramirez, that street cart vendor in L.A. we told you about, who got into an altercation back in July? He had been approached by an angry pedestrian who told him his cart was blocking the sidewalk. Ramirez said it wasn't, and long story short, the man pushed the cart over, severely damaging it. Ramirez filmed the whole thing, and that video, well, according to Saul Gonzalez of KCRW in Santa Monica, it turned Ramirez into a celebrity.
This really captured the imagination of a lot of people here in Los Angeles because it was an example of this man, the street vendor, Mr. Ramirez, standing up for his rights and really, you know, not moving. And after this incident was captured on video and went viral, people started contacting him, writing in support of him on social media. A couple of groups did these, they composed Mexican corridos, which is kind of these Mexican folk songs to tell his story. And Mr. Ramirez got his 15 minutes of fame.
He got more than just songs, though. Members of the community pitched in, and they recently got Ramirez a new cart. And this cart is seriously tricked out.
It has, you know, fat tires. It's kind of an all-terrain vehicle, nice hand grips, and there's a kind of like mini murals of corn around it. So he'll be, if he wasn't noticeable before, he'll be that much more noticeable as he's selling his grilled corn on the streets of L.A.
Ramirez is in business again, selling grilled corn and shaved ice back on his usual corner. Saul Gonzalez says the difference now is that he's become a kind of symbol.
I think it's an example, all this help of Mr. Ramirez really speaking for thousands of people who are involved in the street economy of LA, right? The people who sell food, who sell items on the streets of Los Angeles, but who don't get a lot of attention.
But a street cart with fat tires and mini corn murals, that'll be a little hard to ignore. David Harrington is also a wandering street vendor of sorts, except the founder of Kronos Quartet pedal sounds from around the globe, as interpreted through the adventurous minds of a cellist, a violist, and two violinists, plus anything else that Harrington and his group want in the mix, like the voice of Malian singer Hawa Kase Marijabate.
Kanimba, 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 kanimba.
This is from Kronos Quartet's latest collaboration, which comes out next week. It's with Trio Dakali, three traditional griot musicians from Mali. This fusion of sounds from around the globe within the construct of a chamber ensemble has been the core of Kronos for 44 years. Don't try and come up with a label for it, though. Classical fusion, world classical, world music.
I have to say that I am getting more confused by not only that term, but every musical term to try to define genres or sorts of music.
That's David Harrington of Kronos Quartet. This year, we've been marking the 30th anniversary of the creation of the label World Music, speaking with some of the artists whose music helped make that label a thing. Artists like Bonnie Raitt and Mickey Hart. And now, today, David Harrington of Kronos Quartet.
Maybe the world of music is just getting more interesting and more fascinating all the time. And maybe that's what it is. I don't know.
I mean, it was a marketing term when it was created. World music was created in 1987. And in 1987, with Kronos Quartet, you'd already been listening to and playing with sounds from around the world. What led you to those sounds in the first place? Like, what was it about David Harrington and Kronos that wanted to hear the globe?
Well, it started when I was a kid, and I heard Bartok's music for the first time. And at my high school, there was some amazing recordings of African music, drumming music from Ghana. I remember these 78 recordings at my high school. And I guess you could say I've been trying to enlarge my own definition of what music is ever since then.
However you want to label the sound that Kronos Quartet makes, it's led them to some surprising and extraordinary collaborators. I recall the Kronos 2002 recording Nuevo, which was focused on Mexico's musical culture. And for me, there's that poignant version of Perfidia, kind of a schmaltzy but lovely tune. And there's a musician you featured named Carlos Garcia. He played a leaf on the song, like a leaf, literally a leaf from a tree. Tell me about that moment.
Well, that moment happened around Christmas time in 1995 when my wife and daughter and I were in Mexico City and we were out walking. And I kept hearing what I thought was a violin, and we kind of followed the sound. And as we got closer, this violin became stranger and stranger. And I got very close, and there was Carlos playing Perfidia on, as you say, it was an ivy leaf. And not only that, but he was doing it one-handed. He had lost one of his arms. And I realized I wanted to be a backup band for Carlos. That's what I wanted Carlos to do. That's how that recording came about.
Well, you guys did a great job as a backing band. Is there a part of the world that you really want to take the quartet into musically but have not yet?
Well, there's a lot of places. It seems like the world is getting more fascinating musically. You know, we were in Colombia, in Bogota, Colombia, and we played music by Mario Galeano, and he had written two pieces for us. And I just realized, you know, I want to do a tour of every country in Latin and South America, and I want to get to know all the music possible in the Americas. And I feel like Kronos is very lucky. We've had some astonishing moments in our work so far. And you know, we get inspired by a lot of people.
Well, don't stop being curious. We are so lucky that you and Kronos Quartet are. David Harrington, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
More terrific sounds there from the new Kronos Quartet collaboration with Trio Dakali from Mali. The album is called La Dilikan, and it drops next week. April Peavy, our director on the other side of the glass, you've got this in rotation a lot right now, yeah?
I certainly do. I absolutely love this album. One of my favorite releases this year.
Gotta check it out, everybody. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.